Richmond. Why Richmond?
That is easy. Love.
She says this flatly, with no trace of feeling one way or another about it. The temperature has dropped as the night deepens, and Marino's big, booted feet crunch through crusty snow.
What love? I ask her.
A person who proved to be a waste of time. Marino kicks the running board to knock snow loose before climbing inside his throbbing truck, engine rumbling like the bowels of a great ship, exhaust rushing out. He senses I am looking, and puts on a bigger act of pretending he is unaware or doesn't care as he pulls his door shut and shoves his behemoth into gear. Snow spits out from huge tires as he drives off. Anna shuts the front door while I stand before it, lost in a vortex of spiraling thoughts and feelings.
"We must get you settled," she says to me, touching my arm and motioning for me to follow her.
I come too.
He's angry with me.
If he were not angry about something, or rude, I would think he is ill.
He's angry at me because I almost got murdered.
I sound very tired.
Everybody's angry with me.
You are exhausted. She pauses in the entrance hallway to hear what I have to say.
I'm supposed to apologize because someone tried to kill me?
The protests tumble out.
I asked for it. I did something wrong. So I opened my door. I wasn't perfect, but I'm here, aren't I? I'm alive, aren't I? We're all alive and well, aren't we? Why is everybody angry with me?
Everybody isn't, Anna replies.
Why is it my fault?
Do you think it is your fault?
She studies me with an expression that can only be described as radiological.
Anna sees right through to my bones.
Of course not, I reply. I know it's not my fault.
She deadbolts the door, then sets the alarm and takes me into the kitchen. I try to remember the last time I ate, or what day of the week it is. Then it glimmers. Saturday. I've already asked that several times now. 20 hours have passed since I almost died. The table is set for two, and a large pot of soup simmers on the stove. I smell baking bread, and am suddenly nauseous and starved at the same time, and despite all this, a detail registers. If Anna was expecting Lucy, why isn't the table set for three?
When will Lucy go back to Miami?
Anna seems to read my thoughts as she lifts the lid off the pot and stirs with a long wooden spoon.
What would you like, scotch?
A strong one. She pulls the cork out of a bottle of Glenmorangie Sherrywood Finish single malt whiskey and pours its precious rosy essence over ice in cut crystal tumblers.
I don't know when Lucy will go back. Have no idea, really.
I begin to fill in the blanks for her. ATF was involved in a takedown in Miami that turned bad, very bad. There was a shooting.
Lucy...
Yes, yes, Kay, I know that part. Anna hands me my drink. She can sound impatient even when she is very calm.
It was all over the news, and I called you, remember? We talked about Lucy.
Oh, that's right, I mutter. Anna takes the chair across from me, elbows on the table, leaning into our conversation. She is an amazingly intense, fit woman, tall and firm, a Leni Riefenstahl enlightened beyond her time and undaunted by the years. Her blue warm-up suit turns her eyes the same startling shade of cornflowers, and her silver hair is pulled back in a neat ponytail, held by a black velvet band. I don't know for a fact that she had a facelift or any other cosmetic work, but I suspect modern medicine has something to do with the way she looks. Anna could easily pass for a woman in her 50s.
I assume Lucy came to stay with you while the incident is investigated, she comments. I can only imagine the red tape.
The takedown had gone about as badly as one could. Lucy killed two members of an international gun-smuggling cartel that we now believe is connected to Chandon's crime family. She inadvertently wounded Joe, a DEA agent who at the time was her lover. Red tape is not the word for it. But I'm not sure you know the part about Joe, I tell Anna, her Haida partner.
I do not know what Haida is.
High-intensity drug trafficking area. A squad made up of different law enforcement agencies working violent crimes. ATF, DEA, FBI, Miami-Dade, I tell her. When the takedown went to hell 2 weeks ago, Joe got shot in the leg. It turned out the bullet was fired from Lucy's own gun. Anna listens, sipping scotch. So Lucy accidentally shot Joe, and then, of course, what comes out next is their personal relationship, I continue, which has been very strained. I don't know what's going on with them now, to tell you the truth, but Lucy is here. I guess she'll stay through the holidays, and then who knows?
I did not know she and Janet had broken up, Anna observes.
Quite a while ago.
I am very sorry.
She is sincerely bothered by the news.
I liked Janet very much.
I look down at my soup. It has been a long time since Janet was a topic of conversation. Lucy never says a word about her. I realize I miss Janet very much and still think she was a very stabilizing, mature influence on my niece. If I am honest, I really don't like Joe. I'm not sure why. Maybe, I consider as I reach for my drink, it is simply because she isn't Janet.
And Joe's enrichment? Anna digs for more of the story.
Ironically, she's from here, even though that's not how she and Lucy ended up together. They met in Miami through work. Joe will be recovering for a while, staying in Richmond with her parents, I guess. Don't ask me how that's going to work. They're fundamentalist Christians and not exactly supportive of their daughter's lifestyle.
Lucy never picks anything easy, Anna says, and she is right. Shootings and more shootings. What is it with her and shooting people? Thank goodness she did not kill again.
The weight in my chest presses down harder. My blood seems to have turned into a heavy metal.
What is it with her and killing? Anna pushes. What happened this time worries me, if what I've heard on TV is to be believed.
I haven't turned on TV. I don't know what they're saying. I sip my drink and think about cigarettes again. I have quit so many times in my life.
She almost killed him, that Frenchman, Jean-Baptiste Chandon. She had the gun pointed at him, but you stopped her.
Anna's eyes bore through my skull, probing for secrets.
You tell me.
I described to her what happened. Lucy had gone to the Medical College of Virginia to bring Joe home from the hospital, and when they pulled up to my house after midnight, Chandon and I were in the front yard. The Lucy I conjure up in my memory seems a stranger, a violent person I don't know, her face unrecognizably twisted by rage as she pointed the pistol at him, finger on the trigger, and I pleaded with her not to shoot. She was screaming at him, cursing him as I called out to her, "No, no, Lucy, no!" Chandon was in unspeakable pain, blind and thrashing, rubbing snow into his chemically burned eyes, howling and begging for someone to help him. At this point, Anna interrupts my story.
"Was he speaking French?" she asks.
The question catches me off guard. I try to remember.
"I think so."
"Then you understand French?" I pause again. "Well, I took it in high school. I just know it seemed at the time he was screaming for me to help him. I seemed to understand what he was saying."
"Did you try to help him?"
"I was trying to save his life, trying to stop Lucy from killing him."
"But that was for Lucy, not for him. You weren't really trying to save his life. You were trying to stop Lucy from ruining her own."
Thoughts collide, cancelling each other out. I don't reply.
"She wanted to kill him," Anna goes on. "This was clearly her intention."
I nod, staring off, reliving it.
"Lucy! Lucy!"
I repeatedly called out her name, trying to shatter the homicidal spell she was under.
"Lucy!"
I crawled closer to her in the snowy front yard. "Put the gun down! Lucy, you don't want to do this! Please, put the gun down!" Shandun rolled and writhed, making the horrible sounds of a wounded animal, and Lucy was on her knees in combat position, gun shaking in both hands as she pointed it at his head. Then feet and legs were all around us, ATF agents and police in dark battle dress clutching rifles and pistols had swarmed into my yard. Not one of them knew what to do, as I begged my niece not to kill Shandun in cold blood. "There's been enough killing," I pled with Lucy as I pulled myself within inches of her, my left arm fractured and useless. "Don't do this! Don't do this, please! We love you!"
"You are quite certain it was Lucy's intention to kill him, even though it wasn't self-defense?" Anna asks again.
"Yes," I reply. "I'm certain."
"Then should we reconsider that perhaps it was not necessary for her to kill those men down in Miami?"
"That was totally different, Anna," I reply. "And I can't blame Lucy for the way she reacted when she saw him in front of my house. Saw him and me on the ground in the snow, not even 10 feet from each other. She knew about the other cases here, the murders of Kim Luong and Diane Bray. She knew damn well why he had come to my house, what he planned for me. How would you feel if you had been Lucy?"
"I cannot imagine."
"That's right," I reply. "I don't think anyone can imagine something like that until it happens. I know if I were the one driving up and it was Lucy in the yard and he had tried to murder her, then..."
I pause, analyzing, not really able to complete the thought.
"You would have killed him."
Anna finishes what she must suspect I was going to say.
"Well, I might have.
Even though he was no threat, he was in terrible pain, blind and helpless."
"It's hard to know the other person is helpless, Anna. What did I know outside in the snow, in the dark, with a fractured arm, terrorized?"
"Ah, but you knew enough to talk Lucy out of killing him."
She gets up, and I watch as she unhooks a ladle from the iron rack of pots and pans suspended overhead and fills big earthenware bowls, steam rising in aromatic clouds. She sets the soup on the table, giving me time to think about what she just said.
"Have you ever considered that your life reads like one of your more complicated death certificates?" Anna then says. "Due to, due to, due to, due to."
She motions with her hands, conducting her own orchestra of emphasis.
"Where you find yourself now is due to this and that, and due to on, and it all goes back to the original injury, your father's death."
I search to remember what I have told her about my past.
"You are who you are in life because you became a student of death at a very young age," she continues. "Most of your childhood you lived with your father's dying."
The soup is chicken vegetable, and I detect bay leaves and sherry. I'm not sure I can eat. Anna slips mitts over her hands and slides sourdough rolls out of the oven. She serves hot bread on small plates with butter and honey.
"It seems to be your karma to return to the scene, so to speak, over and over," she analyzes. "The scene of your father's death, of that original loss, as if somehow you will undo it. But all you do is repeat it. The oldest pattern in human nature. I see it daily."
"This isn't about my father." I pick up my spoon. "This isn't about my childhood, and to tell you the truth, the last thing I care about right now is my childhood.
It is about not feeling."
She pulls out her chair and sits back down.
"About learning not to feel because it was too painful to feel."
The soup is too hot to eat, and she idly stirs it with a heavy engraved silver spoon.
"When you were a child, you could not live with the impending doom in your house, the fear, the grief, the anger. You shut down."
"Sometimes you have to do that."
"It is never good to do that," she shakes her head.
"Sometimes it's survival to do that." I disagree.
"Shutting down is denial. When you deny the past, you will repeat it. You are living proof. Your life has been one loss after another ever since that original loss. Ironically, you have turned loss into a profession. The doctor who hears the dead, the doctor who sits at the bedside of the dead. Your divorce from Tony, Mark's death, then last year Benton's murder, then Lucy in a shootout and you almost lose her, and now, finally, you. This terrible man comes to your house and you almost lost you. Losses and more losses.
The pain from Benton's murder is frighteningly fresh. I fear it will always be fresh, that I will never escape the hollowness, the echo of empty rooms in my soul and the anguish in my heart. I'm outraged all over again as I think of the police in my house, unwittingly touching items that belong to Benton, brushing past his paintings, tracking mud over the fine rug in the dining room he gave me for Christmas one year. No one knowing, no one caring.
A pattern like this, Anna comments, if it isn't arrested, takes on an unstoppable energy and sucks everything into its black hole.
I tell her my life is not in a black hole. I don't deny there is a pattern. I would have to be as dense as dirt not to see it. But on one point I am in adamant disagreement.
It bothers me considerably to hear you imply I brought him to my door, I tell her, referring again to Sean Dunn, whom I can scarcely bear to call by name. That somehow I set everything into motion to bring a killer into my house.
If that's what I hear you saying. If that is what you're saying.
It is what I am asking.
She butters a roll.
It is what I am asking you, Kay, she somberly repeats.
Anna, how in God's name can you think I would somehow bring about my own murder?
Because you would not be the first or last person to do something like that. It is not conscious.
Not me. Not subconsciously or unconsciously, I claim.
There is much self-fulfilled prophecy here. You, then Lucy. She almost became what she fights. Be careful who you choose for an enemy, because that is who you become most like.
Anna tosses Nietzsche's quote up into the air. She serves up words she has heard me say in the past.
I didn't will him to come to my house, I repeat slowly and flatly. I continue to avoid saying Sean Dunn's name, because I don't want to give him the power of being a real person to me.
How did he know where you live? Anna continues her questioning.
It's been in the news numerous times over the years, unfortunately, I conjecture. I don't know how he knew.
What? He went to the library and looked up your address on microfilm? This creature so hideously deformed who rarely went out in the light of day? This dog-faced congenital anomaly, almost every inch of his face, his body covered with long lanugo hair, pale baby-fine hair? He went to the public library?
She lets the absurdity of this hover over us.
I don't know how he knew, I repeat. Where he was hiding isn't far from my house.
I am getting upset.
Don't blame me. No one has a right to blame me for what he did. Why are you blaming me?
We create our own worlds. We destroy our own worlds.
It is that simple, Kay, she answers me.
I can't believe you think for a minute I wanted him coming after me. I, of all people.
An image of Kim Luong flashes. I remember fractured facial bones crunching beneath my latex-gloved fingers. I remember the pungent sweet odor of coagulating blood in the airless hot storeroom where Sean Dunn dragged her dying body so he could release his frenzied lust, beating and biting and smearing her blood.
Those women didn't bring this upon themselves either, I say with emotion.
I did not know those women, Anna says. I cannot speak to what they did or did not do. An image of Diane Bray flashes, her arrogant beauty savaged, destroyed, and crudely displayed on the bare mattress inside her bedroom. She was completely unrecognizable by the time he finished with her, seeming to hate her more completely than he did Kim Luong, more completely than the women we believe he murdered in Paris before he came to Richmond. I wonder out loud to Anna if Sean Dunn recognized himself in Bray and it excited his self-hate to its highest level. Diane Bray was cunning and cold. She was cruel and abused power as readily as she breathed air. "You had every good reason to hate her," is Anna's reply. This stops me in my mental tracks. I don't respond right away. I try to remember if I have ever said I hate someone, or worse, if I have actually been guilty of it. To hate another person is wrong. It is never right. Hate is a crime of the spirit that leads to crimes of the flesh. Hate is what brings so many of my patients to my door. I tell Anna that I didn't hate Diane Bray, even though she made it her mission to overpower me and almost succeeded in getting me fired. Bray was pathologically jealous and ambitious. But no, I tell Anna, I didn't hate Diane Bray. She was evil, I conclude, but she didn't deserve what he did to her. Certainly she didn't invite it.
You don't think so? Anna questions all of it. You do not think he did to her symbolically what she was doing to you? Obsession? Forcing her way into your life when you were vulnerable? Attacking, degrading, destroying, an overpowering that aroused her, perhaps even sexually? What is it you have told me so many times? People die the way they lived.
Many of them do. Did she?
Symbolically, as you put it, I reply.
Maybe.
And you, Kay? Did you almost die the way you lived?
I didn't die, Anna.
But you almost did, she says again. And before he came to your door, you had almost given up. You almost stopped living when Benton did.
Tears touch my eyes.
What do you think might have happened to you had Diane Bray not died? Anna then asks.
Bray ran the Richmond Police Department and fooled people who mattered. In a very short time, she made a name for herself throughout Virginia, and ironically, her narcissism, her lust for power and recognition, it appears, may be what lured Shandun to her.
I wonder if he stalked her first. I wonder if he stalked me, and suppose the answer to both questions is that he must have.
Do you think you'd still be the chief medical examiner if Diane Bray were alive?
Anna's stare is unwavering.
I wouldn't have let her win. I taste my soup and my stomach flops. I don't care how diabolical she was, I wouldn't have allowed it. My life is up to me. It was never up to her. My life is mine to make or ruin.
Perhaps you are glad she is dead, Anna says.
The world's better off without her. I push the placemat and everything on it well away from me. That's the truth. The world is better off without people like her. The world would be better off without him.
Better off without Shandun?
I nod.
Then perhaps you wish Lucy had killed him after all? She quietly suggests.
And Anna has a way of demanding truth without being aggressive or judging.
Maybe you would pull the switch, as they say?
No, I shake my head. No, I would not pull the switch on anyone. I can't eat. I'm sorry you went to so much trouble. I hope I'm not coming down with something.
We have talked enough for now. Anna is suddenly the parent, deciding it is time for bed. Tomorrow is Sunday, a good day to stay in and be quiet and rest. I'm clearing my calendar, cancelling all my appointments for Monday, and then I'll cancel Tuesday and Wednesday and the rest of the week, if need be.
I try to object, but she won't hear it.
The good thing about being my age is I can do whatever the hell I want, she adds. I'm on call for emergencies, but that is all, and right now you are my biggest emergency, Kay.
I'm not an emergency. I get up from the table.
Anna helps me with my luggage and takes me down a long hallway that leads to the west wing of her majestic home. The guest room where I am to stay for an undetermined period of time is dominated by a large yew wood bed that, like much of the furniture in her house, is pale gold Biedermeier. Her decor is restrained with straight and simple lines, but cumulus down-filled duvets and pillows and heavy draperies that flow in champagne silk waterfalls to the hardwood floor hint at her true nature.
Anna's motivation in life is the comfort of others, to heal and to banish pain and celebrate pure beauty. "What else do you need?" She hangs up my clothes. I help put away other items in dresser drawers and realize I am trembling again. "Do you need something to sleep?" She lines up my shoes on the closet floor. Taking an Ativan or some other sedative is a tempting proposition that I resist. "I've always been afraid to make it a habit," I vaguely respond. "You can see how I am with cigarettes. I can't be trusted." Anna looks at me. "It is very important you get sleep, Kay. No better friend to depression." I'm not sure what she is saying, but I know what she means. I am depressed. I am probably going to be depressed, and sleep deprivation makes everything so much worse. Throughout my life, insomnia has flared up like arthritis, and when I became a physician, I had to resist the easy habit of indulging in one's own candy store. Prescription drugs have always been there. I have always stayed away from them. Anna leaves me, and I sit up in bed with the lights off, staring into the dark, halfway believing that when morning comes I will find what has happened is just another one of my bad dreams, another horror that crept out from my deeper layers when I was not quite conscious. My rational voice probes my interior like a flashlight, but dispels nothing. I can't illuminate any meaning to my almost being mutilated and killed, and how that fact will affect the rest of my life. I can't feel it. I can't make sense of it. God help me. I turn over on my side and shut my eyes. "Now I lay me down to sleep," my mother used to pray with me, but I always thought the words were really more for my father in his sick bed down the hall. Sometimes when my mother would leave my room, I would insert male pronouns into the verses. "If he should die before he wakes, I pray the Lord his soul to take," and I would cry myself to sleep. Chapter 3. I wake up the following morning to voices in the house and have the unsettling sensation that the telephone rang all night. I'm not sure if I dreamed it. For an awful moment I have no idea where I am. Then it comes to me in a sick, fearful wave. I work my way up against pillows and am still for a moment. I can tell through drawn curtains that the sun is aloof again, offering nothing but gray. I help myself to a thick terrycloth robe hanging on the back of the bathroom door and put on a pair of socks before venturing out to see who else is in the house. I hope the visitor is Lucy, and it is. She and Anna are in the kitchen. Small snowflakes sprinkle down past expansive windows overlooking the backyard and the flat Pewter River. Bare trees, etched darkly against the day, move slightly in the wind, and wood smoke rises from the house of the nearest neighbor. Lucy has on a faded warm-up suit left over from when she took computer and robotic courses at MIT. It appears she has styled her short auburn hair with her fingers, and she seems unusually grim and has a glassy-eyed, bloodshot look that I associate with too much booze the night before. "Did you just get here?" I hug her good morning. "Actually, last night," she replies, squeezing me tight. "I couldn't resist. Thought I'd drop by and we'd have a slumber party. But you were down for the count. It's my fault for getting here so late." "Oh, no." I go hollow inside. "You should have gotten me up. Why didn't you?" "No way. How's the arm?" "It doesn't hurt as much." This is not at all true. "You checked out of the Jefferson?" "Nope. Still there." Lucy's expression is unreadable. She drops to the floor and pulls off her warm-up pants, revealing bright spandex running tights underneath. "I am afraid your niece was a bad influence," Anna says. "She brought over a very nice bottle of Veuve Clicquot, and we stayed up much too late. I would not let her drive back downtown." I feel a twinge of hurt, or maybe it is jealousy. "Champagne? Are we celebrating something?" I inquire. Anna replies with a slight shrug. She is preoccupied. I sense she carries very heavy thoughts that she does not want to set down before me, and I wonder if the phone really did ring last night. Lucy unzips her jacket, revealing more bright blue and black nylon that fits her strong, athletic body like paint.
Yeah, celebrating, Lucy says, bitterness lacing her voice. ATF's put me on admin leave.
I can't believe I heard her right. Administrative leave is the same thing as being suspended. It is the first step in being fired. I glance at Anna for any sign that she already knows about this, but she seems just as surprised as I am.
They've put me on the beach.
ATF slang for suspension.
I'll get a letter in the next week or so that will cite all my transgressions.
Lucy acts blasé, but I know her too well to be fooled. Anger is about all I have seen boiling out of her over recent months and years, and it is there now, molten beneath her many complex layers.
They'll give me all the reasons I should be terminated and I get to appeal, unless I decide to just fuck it and quit, which I might. I don't need them.
Why? What on earth happened? Not because of him. I mean Sean Dunn. With rare exception, when an agent has been in a shooting or some other critical incident, the routine is to immediately involve him in peer support and reassign him to a less stressful job, such as arson investigation, instead of the dangerous undercover work Lucy was doing in Miami. If the individual is emotionally unable to cope, he might even be granted traumatic leave time. But administrative leave is another matter. It is punishment, plain and simple.
Lucy looks up at me from her seat on the floor, legs straight out, hands planted behind her back.
"It's the old damned if you do, damned if you don't," she retorts. "If I'd shot him, I'd have hell to pay. I didn't shoot him, and I have hell to pay."
"You were in a shootout in Miami. Then very soon after, you come to Richmond and almost shot someone else."
Anna states the truth.
It doesn't matter if the someone else is a serial killer who broke into my house. Lucy has a history of resorting to force that predates even the incident in Miami. Her troubled past presses down heavily in Anna's kitchen like a low-pressure front.
"I'm the first to admit it," Lucy replies. "All of us wanted to blow him away. You don't think Marino did?" She meets my eyes. "You don't think every cop, every agent who showed up at your house didn't want to pull the trigger? They think I'm some kind of soldier of fortune, some psycho who gets off on killing people. At least that's what they're hinting at."
"You do need time off," Anna says bluntly. "Maybe it is about that, and nothing more."
"That's not what this is about. Come on. If one of the guys had done what I did in Miami, he'd be a hero. If one of the guys almost killed Sean Dunn, the suits in D.C. would be applauding his restraint, not nailing him down for almost doing something. How can you punish someone for almost doing something? In fact, how can you even prove someone almost did something?"
"Well, they'll have to prove it," the lawyer, the investigator in me, tells her.
At the same time, I am reminded that Sean Dunn almost did something to me. He didn't actually do it, no matter his intention, and his eventual legal defense will make a big issue of this fact.
"They can do whatever they want," Lucy replies, as hurt and outrage swell. "They can fire me, or bring me back in and park my butt at a desk in some little windowless room somewhere in South Dakota or Alaska, or bury me in some chicken shit department like audiovisual."
"Kay, you haven't had coffee yet." Anna attempts to dispel the mounting tension.
"So maybe that's my problem. Maybe that's why nothing's making any sense this morning."
I head to the drip machine near the sink. "Anybody else?"
There are no other takers.
I pour a cup as Lucy leans into deep stretches, and it is always amazing to watch her move, liquid and supple, her muscles calling attention to themselves without deliberation or fanfare. Having started life pudgy and slow, she has spent years engineering herself into a machine that will respond the way she demands, very much like the helicopters she flies. Maybe it is her Brazilian blood that adds the dark fire to her beauty, but Lucy is electrifying. People fix their eyes on her wherever she goes, and her reaction is a shrug.
at most. "I don't know how you can go out and run in weather like this," Anna says to her. "I like pain." Lucy snaps on her butt pack, a pistol inside it. "We need to talk more about this. Figure out what you're going to do." Caffeine defibrillates my slow heart and jolts me back into a clear head. "After I run, I'm going to work out in the gym," Lucy tells us. "I'll be gone for a while." "Pain and more pain," Anna muses. All I can think of when I look at my niece is how extraordinary she is and how much unfairness life has dealt her. She never knew her biological father, and then Benton came along and was the father she never had, and she lost him, too. Her mother is a self-centered woman who is too competitive with Lucy to love her, if my sister Dorothy is capable of loving anyone, and I really don't believe she is. Lucy is possibly the most intelligent, intricate person I know. It has not earned her many fans. She has always been irrepressible, and as I watch her spring out of the kitchen like an Olympic runner, armed and dangerous, I'm reminded of when she began the first grade at age 4 1/2 and flunked conduct. "How do you flunk conduct?" I asked Dorothy when she called me in a rage to complain about the horrible hardship of being Lucy's mother. "She talks all the time and interrupts the other students, and is always raising her hand to answer questions," Dorothy blurted over the phone. "Do you know what her teacher wrote on her report card? Here, let me read it to you. Lucy does not work and play well with others. She is a show-off and a know-it-all, and is constantly taking things apart, such as the pencil sharpener and doorknobs." Lucy is gay. That is probably most unfair of all, because she can't outgrow it or get over it. Homosexuality is unfair because it creates unfairness. For that reason, it broke my heart when I found out this part of my niece's life. I desperately don't want her to suffer. I also force myself to admit that I have managed to ignore the obvious up until now. ATF isn't going to be generous or forgiving, and Lucy has probably known this for a while. Administration in D.C. won't look at all she has accomplished, but will focus on her through the distorting lens of prejudice and jealousy. "It'll be a witch hunt," I say after Lucy has left the house. Anna cracks eggs into a bowl. "They want her gone, Anna." She drops shells into the sink and opens the refrigerator, pulling out a carton of milk, glancing at the expiration date. "There are those who think she is a hero," she says. "Law enforcement tolerates women. It doesn't celebrate them, and punishes those who become heroes. That's the dirty little secret no one wants to talk about," I say. Anna vigorously whips eggs with a fork. "It's our same story," I continue. "We went to medical school in a day when we had to apologize for taking men's slots. In some cases we were shunned, sabotaged. I had 3 other women in my first year medical school class. How many did you have?" "It was different in Vienna." "Vienna?" My thoughts evaporate. "Where I was trained," she informs me. "Oh." I experience guilt again as I learn another detail I don't know about my good friend. "When I came here, everything you are saying about how it is for women was exactly like that." Anna's mouth is set in a hard line as she pours egg batter into a cast-iron skillet. "I remember what it was like when I moved to Virginia, how I was treated. Believe me, I know all about it. I was 30 years ahead of you, Kay. You really don't know all about it." Eggs steam and bubble. I lean against the counter, drinking black coffee, wishing I had been awake when Lucy came in last night, aching because I didn't talk to her. I had to find out her news like this, almost as a by the way. "Did she talk to you?" I ask Anna. "About what she just told us?" She folds the eggs over and over. "Looking back on it, I think she showed up with champagne because she wanted to tell you. Rather an inappropriate effect, considering her news." She pops multigrain English muffins out of the toaster. "It is easy to assume that psychiatrists have such deep conversations with everyone, when, in truth, people rarely tell me their true feelings, even when they pay me by the hour.
She carries our plates to the table.
Mostly people tell me what they think. That is the problem. People think too much. They won't be blatant.
I am preoccupied with ATF again, as Anna and I sit across from each other.
Their attack will be covert, like the FBI. And in truth, the FBI ran her off for the same reason.
She was their rising star. A computer wizard, a helicopter pilot, the first female member of the hostage rescue team. I rush through Lucy's resume as Anna's expression turns increasingly skeptical. We both know it is unnecessary for me to recite all this. She has known Lucy since Lucy was a child.
Then the gay card was played.
I can't stop.
Well, here we go again, and she left them for ATF. On and on, history repeated.
Why are you looking at me like that?
Because you are consuming yourself with Lucy's problems, when your own loom larger than Mont Blanc.
My attention wanders out the window. A blue jay helps himself to the bird feeder, feathers ruffling, sunflower seeds falling and peppering the snowy earth like lead shot. Pale fingers of sunlight probe the overcast morning. I nervously turn my coffee cup in small circles on the table. My elbow throbs slowly and deeply as we eat. Whatever my problems are, I resist talking about them, as if to voice them will somehow give them life, as if they don't have life already. Anna doesn't push. We are quiet. Silverware clinks against plates, and snow drifts down more thickly, frosting shrubbery and trees and hovering foggily over the river. I return to my room and take a long hot bath, my cast propped on the side of the tub. I am dressing with difficulty, realizing that I am not likely to ever master tying shoes with one hand, when the doorbell rings. Moments later, Anna knocks and asks me if I am decent. Thoughts bloom darkly and roll like storms. I'm not expecting company.
Who is it? I call out.
Buford Reiter, she says. Chapter 4. Behind his back, the city commonwealth's attorney is called many things. Easy Reiter, he is weak. Reiter Wrong, wishy-washy. Fighter Reiter, anything but. Buford, scared of his own shadow. Always proper, always appropriate, Reiter is always the Virginia gentleman he was trained to be in the Caroline County horse country of his roots. No one loves him, no one hates him. He is neither feared nor respected. Reiter has no fire. I can't recall ever seeing him emotional, no matter how cruel or heart-wrenching the case. Worse, he is squeamish when it comes to the details I bring to the forum, preferring to focus on points of law and not the appalling human messiness left by its violations. His avoidance of the morgue has resulted in his not being as well versed in forensic science and medicine as he ought to be. In fact, he is the only seasoned prosecutor I know who doesn't seem to mind stipulating cause of death. In other words, he allows the paper record to speak for the medical examiner in the courtroom. This is a travesty. To me, it constitutes malpractice. When the medical examiner isn't in the courtroom, then, in a sense, neither is the body, and jurors don't envision the victim or what he went through during the process of dying violently. Clinical words on protocols simply don't evoke the terror or the suffering, and for this reason it is usually the defense, not the prosecution, who wants to stipulate cause of death.
Buford, how are you?
I hold out my hand, and he glances at my cast and my sling, and down at my untied shoelaces and my shirt tail hanging out. He has never seen me in anything less than a suit, and in a setting that befits my professional rank, and his brow knits into an expression that is supposed to evince genteel compassion and understanding, the humility and caring of those hand-picked by God to rule the rest of us lesser creatures. His type abounds among the first families of Virginia, a privileged, dusty people who have refined the skill of disguising their elitism and arrogance beneath a heavy aura of burden, as if it is so damn hard to be them.
The question is, how are you? He says,
sitting back down in Anna's handsome oval living room with its vaulted ceiling and view of the river.
"I really don't know how to answer that, Buford." I choose a rocking chair. Every time someone asks, my mind reboots.
Anna must have just gotten the fire going and has vanished, and I have the uneasy sensation that her absence is about more than her being politely unobtrusive.
No small wonder. Don't even know how you're able to function after what you've been through.
Ryder speaks with a syrupy Virginia drawl.
Sure, I'm sorry to barge in like this, Kay, but something's come up. Something unexpected. Nice place, isn't it?
He continues to survey his surroundings.
She build, or was it already here?
I don't know or care.
You two are pretty close, I gather, he adds.
I'm not sure if he is making small talk or fishing.
She's been a good friend, I reply. I know she thinks the world of you. All of which is to say, he goes on, that you couldn't be in better hands right now, in my opinion.
I resent his implying that I am in anybody's hands, as if I am a patient or a ward, and I say so.
Oh, I see.
He continues his scan of oil paintings on pale rose walls, of art glass and sculptures and European furniture.
Then you don't have a professional relationship? Never have?
Not literally, I reply testily. I have never had an appointment.
She ever prescribed medications for you?
He blandly goes on. Not that I recall.
Well, can't believe it's almost Christmas,
Ryder sighs, his attention wandering back in from the river, back to me. To use a Lucy term, he looks dorky in Bavarian button-up heavy green wool pants tucked into fleece-lined rubber boots with big tread. He wears a plaid Burberry-type wool sweater buttoned up to his chin, as if he can't decide whether he...
Well, he says, let me tell you why I'm here. Marino called a couple hours ago. There's been an unanticipated development in the Chandon case.
The stab of betrayal is instant. Marino has told me nothing. He hasn't even bothered to see how I am doing this morning.
I'll give you a summation as best I can.
Ryder crosses his legs and demurely places his hands in his lap, a thin wedding band and University of Virginia class ring glinting in lamplight.
Kay, I'm sure you're aware the news of what happened at your house and the subsequent apprehension of Chandon has been broadcast all over. I mean all over. I'm sure you've followed it and can appreciate the magnitude of what I'm about to say.
Fear is a fascinating emotion. I have studied it endlessly, and often tell people the best example of how it works is to recall the reaction of another driver you have pulled in front of and almost hit. Panic instantly turns to rage, and the other person lays on the horn, makes obscene gestures, or these days, shoots you. I go through the progression completely, flawlessly, shrill fear turning to fury. I've not followed the news deliberately and certainly won't appreciate the magnitude of it, I reply. I never appreciate having my privacy violated.
The murders of Kim Luong and Diane Bray created a lot of attention, but nothing like this, the murder attempt on you, he continues. I'm supposing, then, you didn't see the Washington Post this morning?
I just stare at him, seething.
Front-page photo of Chandon in the stretcher being carried into the ER, his hairy shoulders sticking out of the sheets, like some sort of long-haired dog. Of course, his face was covered by bandages, but you certainly could get the sense of how grotesque he is. And the tabloids, you can imagine. Werewolf in Richmond. Beauty and the Beast. That sort of thing.
Disdain creeps around the edges of his voice, as if sensationalism is obscene, and I am subjected to an unwanted image of him making love to his wife. I can envision him fucking with his socks on. I suspect he would consider sex an indignity, the primitive judge of biology overruling his higher self.
I have heard rumors. In the men's room, he won't use the urinals or toilets in front of anybody. He is a compulsive hand washer. All of this is buzzing through my mind as he continues to sit so properly and disclose the wilting public exposure Sean Dunn has caused me.
Do you know if photographs of my house have shown up anywhere? I have to ask. There were photographers when I came out of my driveway last night.
Well, I do know there have been some helicopters flying over this morning. Someone told me that, he replies, making me instantly suspicious that he has been back at my house again and witnessed this for himself.
Taking aerial shots. He stares out at snow drifting down.
I guess the weather's put a stop to it. The guard gate's been turning away quite a few cars. The press, the curious. In an unexpected way, a damn good thing you're staying with Dr. Zenner. Funny how things work out.
He pauses, staring off toward the river again.
A flock of Canada geese circles, as if waiting for instructions from the tower.
Normally, what I'd recommend is you don't return to your house until after the trial.
Until after the trial? I interrupt.
That would be if the trial were here. He leads up to his next revelation, which I automatically assume is a reference to a change of venue.
You're saying the trial will probably be moved out of Richmond, I interpolate.
And what do you mean by normally?
That's what I'm getting to. Marino got a call from the Manhattan DA's office.
This morning? This is the new development?
I am baffled.
What does New York have to do with anything?
This was a few hours ago, he goes on. The head of the Sex Crimes Division, a woman named Jamie Berger, a weird name spelled J-A-I-M-E but pronounced Jamie. You may have heard of her. In fact, I wouldn't be surprised if you two know each other.
We've never met, I reply, but I've heard of her.
Friday, December 5th, 2 years ago, Ryder goes on, the body of a 28-year-old black female was found in New York, an apartment in the area of 2nd Avenue and 77th Street, Upper East Side. Apparently a woman who was a television meteorologist. Did the weather. On CNBC. Don't know if you heard about the case?
I begin to make connections against my will.
When she didn't show up at the studio early that morning, the morning of the 3rd, and didn't answer the phone, someone checked on her.
The victim, Ryder pulls a tiny leather notebook out of his back pants pocket and flips through pages.
Name of Susan Pless. Well, her body's back in her bedroom on the rug by the bed. Clothes ripped off from the waist up, face and head so badly beaten it looks like she was in a plane crash.
He glances up at me.
And that's a quote, the plane crash part. Supposedly how Berger described it to Marino.
What was the word you used to use?
Remember that case where the drunk teenagers were racing in a pickup truck and one of them decides to hang halfway out his window and has the misfortune of encountering a tree?
Bogging. I dully reply, as I take in what he is saying.
Face caved in from severe impact, such as you might find in plane crashes or in cases where people have jumped or fallen from high places and hit face first.
2 years ago?
My thoughts spin.
How can that be?
I won't go into all the gory detail. He is flipping more pages in his notebook. But there were bite marks, including on the hands and feet, and a lot of strange long hairs adhering to blood that at first were presumed to be animal hairs, maybe a long-haired Angora cat or something.
He looks up at me.
You're getting the drift.
All along we have assumed Sean Dunn's trip to Richmond was his first to the United States. We have no logical reason for this assumption beyond our painting him as a Quasimodo of sorts, who spent his life hidden in the basement of his powerful family's Paris home. We also assumed he sailed to Richmond from Antwerp. At the same time, his brother's dead body was headed our way. Are we wrong about that, too?
I toss this out to Ryder.
You know what Interpol conjectured, at any rate, he comments.
That he was aboard the Sirius under an alias, I recall. A man named Pascal, who was immediately taken to the airport when the ship came to port here in Richmond in early December. Supposedly a family emergency required him to fly back to Europe. I repeat information J. Talley presented while I was in Lyon at Interpol last week. But no one ever actually saw him board the plane, so it's been assumed Pascal was really Sean Dunn, and he never flew anywhere but stayed here and started killing. But if this guy readily travels in and out of the U.S., no telling how long he's been in the States or when he got here or anything. So much for theories.
Well, I suppose a lot of them may end up revised before it's all over. No disrespect to Interpol or anyone else intended.
Ryder recrosses his legs and seems strangely pleased.
Has he been located, this Pascal person?
Ryder doesn't know, but he speculates that whoever the real Pascal is, assuming he exists, is probably just one more rotten apple involved with the Chandon family's criminal cartel.
Another guy with an alias, possibly even an associate of the dead guy in the cargo container, Ryder speculates. The brother, I guess. Thomas Chandon, who we certainly know was involved in the family business.
I'm assuming Berger heard the news about Sean Dunn's being caught, heard about his murders, and called us, I say.
Recognized the M.O., that's right. Says the case of Susan Pless has always haunted her. Berger's in a hell-fire hurry to compare DNA. Apparently got seminal fluid, and they've got a profile on it. Have had it for 2 years now.
So the seminal fluid in Susan's case was analyzed. I ponder this, somewhat surprised, because typically overworked, financially stressed labs do not analyze DNA evidence until there is a suspect for comparison, especially if there isn't an extensive databank to run the profile through in hopes of a cold hit. In 1997, New York's databank wasn't even in existence yet.
Does this mean they had a suspect originally? I ask. I think they had one guy in mind who didn't pan out. Ryder replies, "All I know is they did get a profile and were getting Sean Dunn's DNA up there to the M.E.'s office immediately. In fact, the sample's on its way, even as we speak. To state the obvious, we've got to know if it's a match before Sean Dunn's arraigned here in Richmond. Got to cut that off at the pass, and the good news is we're given the gift of at least a few extra days because of his medical condition, because of the chemical burns to his eyes."
He says this as if I had nothing to do with it.
Kind of like the golden hour you always talk about, that brief period of time you've got to save someone who's been in an awful accident or whatever. This is our golden hour. We'll get the DNA compared and see if Sean Dunn is in fact the person who killed the woman in New York 2 years ago.
Ryder has an annoying habit of repeating things I have said, as if being anecdotal somehow lets him off the hook for remaining ignorant about matters that count.
What about bite marks, I ask. Was there any information on those? Sean Dunn has very unusual dentition.
You know, Kay, he says, I really didn't get into those sorts of details.
Of course, he would not have. I push for the truth, for the real reason he has come to see me this morning.
And what if the DNA points to Sean Dunn? You want to know before the arraignment here? Why?
It is a rhetorical question. I think I know why.
You don't want him arraigned here. You intend to turn him over to New York and let him be tried up there first.
He avoids my eyes.
Why in the world would you do that, Buford? I go on as I become convinced that this is exactly what he has decided. So you can wash your hands of him? Ship him up to Rikers Island and be rid of him? And bring no justice to the cases here? Let's just be honest, Buford. If they get a first-degree murder conviction in Manhattan, you won't bother to try him here, now will you?
He gives me one of his sincere looks.
Everyone in the community has always respected you so much, he startles me by saying.
Has always?
Alarm shoots through me like cold water.
As in not anymore?
I'm just telling you I understand how you feel.
that you and these other poor women deserve him punished to the full extent of the—"
"So I guess the bastard just gets away with what he tried to do to me," I hotly cut him off.
Beneath all this is pain, the pain of rejection, the pain of abandonment.
"I guess he just gets away with what he did to these other poor women, as you put it. Am I right?"
"They have the death penalty in New York," he replies.
"Oh, for God's sake!" I exclaim in disgust. I fix on him intensely, hotly, like the focus of the magnifying glass I used in childhood experiments to burn holes in paper and dead leaves. "And when have they ever imposed it?"
He knows the answer is never. No one ever gets the needle in Manhattan.
"And there's no guarantee it would be imposed in Virginia either," Ryder reasonably answers. "The defendant isn't an American citizen. He has a bizarre disease or deformity or whatever it is. We're not even certain he speaks English."
"He certainly spoke English when he came to my house."
"He might get off on insanity, for all we know."
"I guess that depends on the skill of the prosecutor, Buford."
Ryder blinks. His jaw muscles bunch. He looks like a Hollywood parody of an accountant, all buttoned up tight and in tiny glasses, who has just been subjected to an offensive smell.
"Have you talked to Berger?" I ask him. "You must have. You couldn't have come up with this on your own. You two have made a deal."
"We've conferred. There's pressure, Kay. Certainly you've got to appreciate that. For one thing, he's French. You got any idea how the French would react if we tried to execute one of their native sons here in Virginia?"
"Good God!" I blurt out. "This isn't about capital punishment. This is about punishment, period. You know how I feel about capital punishment, Buford. I'm against it. I'm more against it the older I get. But he should be held responsible for what he did here in Virginia, damn it!"
Ryder says nothing, looking out the window again.
"So you and Berger agreed if the DNA matches, Manhattan can have Sean Dunn," I offer my summation.
"Think about it. This is the best we could hope for in terms of change of venue, so to speak."
Ryder gives me his eyes again.
"And you know damn well the case could never be tried here in Richmond with all the publicity and whatnot. We'd probably all get sent out to some rural courthouse a million miles from here, and how would you like to be put through that for weeks, possibly months on end?"
"That's right." I get up and jab logs with the poker, heat pressing against my face, sparks exploding up the chimney like a flock of spooked starlings. "God forbid that we should be inconvenienced."
I jab hard with my good arm, as if I am trying to kill the fire. I sit back down, flushed and suddenly on the verge of tears. I know all about post-traumatic stress syndrome, and accept that I am suffering from it. I am anxious and startle easily. A little while ago I turned on a local classical music station, and Pachelbel overwhelmed me with grief and I began to sob. I know the symptoms. I swallow hard and steady myself. Ryder watches me in silence, that tired look of sad nobility, as if he is Robert E. Lee remembering a painful battle.
"What will happen to me?" I ask. "Or do I just go on with my life now, as if I never worked these god-awful murders, as if I never autopsied his victims or escaped with my life when he forced his way into my house? What will my role in this be, Buford, supposing he's tried in New York?"
"That will be up to Miss Berger," he replies.
"Free lunches."
It is a term I use when referring to victims who never see justice. In the scenario Ryder is suggesting, I, for example, would be a free lunch, because Sean Dunn will never go to trial in New York for what he intended to do to me in Richmond. More unconscionably, he will not be given so much as a slap on the hand for the murders he committed here, either.
"You've just thrown this entire city to the wolves," I tell him.
He realizes the double entendre the same moment I do. I see it in his eyes. Richmond has already been thrown to one wolf, Sean Dunn, whose modus operandi when he began killing in France was to leave notes signed Le Loup-Garou, the werewolf. Now justice for this city's victims will be in the hands of strangers, or more to the point, there will be no justice. Anything can happen. Anything will.
"What if France wants to extradite him?"
I challenge Ryder. What if New York allows it?
We could cite what-ifs until the moon turns blue, he says.
I stare at him with open disdain.
Don't take this personally, Kay.
Ryder gives me that pious, sad look again.
Don't turn this into your personal war. We just want the bastard out of commission. Doesn't matter who accomplishes that.
I get up from my chair. Well, it does matter. It sure as hell does, I tell him. You're a coward, Buford.
I turn my back on him and walk out of the room.
Minutes later, from behind the shut door in my wing of the house, I hear Anna showing Ryder out. Obviously, he lingered long enough to talk to her, and I wonder what he might have said about me. I sit on the edge of my bed, utterly lost. I can't remember ever feeling this lonely, this frightened, and am relieved when I hear Anna coming down the hall. She knocks lightly on my door.
Come in,
I say in an unsteady voice. She stands in the doorway looking at me. I feel like a child, powerless, hopeless, foolish.
I insulted Ryder, I tell her. Doesn't matter if what I said was true. I called him a coward.
He thinks you are unstable right now, she replies. He is concerned. He is also ein Mann ohne Rückgrat, a man without backbone, as we say where I come from. She smiles a little.
Anna, I'm not unstable.
Why are we in here when we can be enjoying the fire? She says. She intends to talk to me.
Okay, I concede. You win.
Chapter 5. I have never been Anna's patient. For that matter, I have never had psychotherapy of any sort, which is not to say I have never needed it. Certainly I have. I don't know anybody who can't benefit from good counsel. It is simply that I am so private and don't trust people easily, and for good reason. There is no such thing as absolute discretion. I am a doctor. I know other doctors. Doctors talk to each other and to their family and friends. They tell secrets that they swear upon Hippocrates they will never utter to another soul. Anna switches off lamps. The late morning is overcast and as dark as dusk, and rose-painted walls catch firelight and make the living room irresistibly cozy. I'm suddenly self-conscious. Anna has set the stage for my unveiling. I pick the rocker, and she pulls an ottoman close and perches on the edge of it, facing me like a great bird hunched over its nest.
You will not get through this if you remain silent.
She is brutally direct. Grief rises in my throat, and I try to swallow it.
You are traumatized, Anna goes on.
Kay, you are not made of steel. Not even you can endure.